was the ticking time bomb of tension which could explode into a conflict.
We were walking right on the edge. We were walking right on the edge.
This world would be a pretty easy and fun place to live if everybody just minded their own business.
We were walking right on the edge. We were walking right on the edge.
Another explosion. Possibly bomb being dropped.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name's David Condon. Welcome to Inside Track. Joining us is Jason Kennedy, as always. Hello, Jason. How you doing, man?
I'm fine, Dave. Hello, everyone.
Right. Was that the first smooth intro to a show, I believe?
Yeah, I believe so. It's taken 11 shows.
Hey, man. Good things come to those who wait.
That is a very slow learning curve, isn't it?
It's having to. I'm left-handed, mate. What do you expect?
I'm left-handed too. That could explain it.
Funny enough, on left-handed people, I was reading something last night about the fact that there was a particular doctor that's theorised that you couldn't have too many left-handed people are known as the more kind of creative and so forth, isn't it? But he was saying if you have too many left-handed people on the planet, society would break down. You need basically more sheep than you do creative, innovative individuals.
Yeah, that's a fascinating observation. I've got another one on the subject of left-handedness. If you meet anyone with the surname Kerr, K-E-R-R, from Scotland,
don't name them Wayne.
Them if they are left-handed. Now, because supposedly there was a clan there called the Kerrs. And they had, for whatever reason, they had more left-handed members than other clans. So they become kind of famous for the left-handed fighting. And one of the reasons that left-handed fighting was kind of useful was in castles, fighting on staircases. And supposedly, if you go to a castle and you look at the staircases inside a castle, they would often have one staircase that was the other way round. And this one was the one that the left-handed fighters would fight with when they were defending the castle. So they would just set aside like a left-handed zone.
That would
interesting,
be,
right?
Yeah. That would be the first initial stage because of this transgendered bathroom thing then.
Kind of. But the thing there is, if you think about it, most staircases inside a castle, if you go and look, they go clockwise.
Right, yeah.
That makes it impossible for a right-handed fighter to swing a sword if they're fighting upwards.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So, there you go, a little left-handed knowledge. Do you have your sword with you today?
Do you know what? I left it clean at home. Oh, hang on.
Mine's in the wash.
In the wash? Oh, no, we've got a little plastic, knife in the studio today. So it's a shame we can't take a picture of it.
We just wield the sword of justice on this show.
Yeah. Right, anyway.
Before
we continue, just on with the show for a second, we'd like to thank Julie for the last 2 hours. And if you'd like to go and check out our website, bookarmor.com, that's bookarmor.com. There's a chat box on there that you can leave messages and any feedback. Please do. Would be lovely to hear from you guys that are listening. Okay, with that, on we go. So, Jay, how's your week been?
I always say it's just been a usual week of work, don't I?
Well, yeah.
That's my usual comment because, I, like the rest of us, have to just get up and go to work each day. But one thing I haven't talked about so much is what I do in the downtime.
Okay.
This week we had a holiday, public holiday. So there were 4 days, a long weekend. And there were two holidays that were going on. The first one is this traditional Chinese holiday, and it's called Tomb Sweeping Day. And this is the day when your family goes to the tomb of your ancestors and cleans it up.
Right, okay.
And many people do this. They're kind of faithful to the tomb sweeping tradition. They don't just lie in bed watching TV and playing on their iPhones. They do go and do this. But I didn't go and do this. I went to some bookshops with the wife. We went exploring, as we usually do at the weekend. And then the other holiday was Children's Day. So the children will go and do some kind of activity, some of them. And that's just a big day for children in Taiwan. I think that was Monday.
Right, okay.
But you might want to talk more about my trips to the bookshops, because I found two very good books this week.
Well, Gannon, what are they?
Well, the one is called Worse Than Slavery. This one's by this guy called David Oshinsky. I hadn't heard of him. I go to these used bookstores. I don't buy any new books here in Taiwan. They're kind of expensive. If I want new books, I get them sent over from a website in the UK that just sends them without any shipping charges. But this is just all used stuff in Taiwan, so I never quite know what I'll find on these trips. So this one was called Worse Than Slavery, and it's all about the prison system that developed in the southern states, specifically kind of Mississippi, after the Civil War in the US. So it's a historical book. I just found it very interesting. And coincidentally, I was coming across stories about, you know, the present state of the prison system in Mississippi. And you do wonder, once you start to investigate, just how much has changed over the century or so.
Probably not much. I know that Trump was recently suggesting that in order to get US manufacturing back on track again, he was looking at, employ prisoners to basically make stuff. I use the word employ very loosely there.
Well, there is a kind of employment going on, but as you'll be aware, if you use inmates to perform this labor, then you don't have to pay them very much. There's different, you can pay them. I saw an article about the large prison in Angola, which is one of the largest prisons in the US, I believe, which was basically more of a kind of plantation than an actual just a prison per se. And in this facility, the inmates earn between 2 cents and 20 cents an hour. This article was written about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So you can pay them way below the minimum wage. And then the other story I was noticing today is not only can you pay them just very, very low rates, inside the prison, it's a closed system. So nothing can come in from the outside. And all kinds of goods are purchased from, it's called the commissary, the shop inside the prison.
Right.
And this commissary is also a license to print money. So there's a story, I'll put it up on the Bookarma after the show, but it was about the extortionate rates being charged by this commissary in Mississippi. And it's kind of four times the price for a lot of the common items like soap or shampoo or toothpaste. And the prisoners, of course, they're not earning enough to pay for these items. So it's effectively a kind of tax on their families. And food is also one of the things that you have to purchase while your family member is inside, because the kind of statistics show that if prisoners don't get any private help with their nutrition, then they tend to lose on average 20 pounds in this prison system if you just eat what's on offer for free. So it's astonishing. And to put it in perspective, how much do you think they're charging a minute to call from some of these prisons? US dollars.
A complete random guess. $10?
$14 a minute.
I wasn't too far off, man. I just said 10 because it was stupidly high.
So that probably some of the highest prices per minute anywhere on the planet for people inside prison to call people in the next town or the next city through the switchboards at the prison. And those rates were so high that the federal agency responsible for overseeing that said, well, you've got to tone it down a little. So that was a story today. This book, if you're going to kind of link together the past and the present, it begins with the slavery, which was in effect, up until the US Civil War. Then after the South lost the Civil War, they entered this brief period afterwards called Reconstruction period. And during that period, it's a little hard to follow if you're used to US politics today. But at that particular time, it was the Democrats who were the old guard, and the Republican Party was the new radical party. And so with Reconstruction, suddenly 60,000 black people in Mississippi could vote, and there were only 40,000 white people there. So overnight, the political power was kind of handed over, and lots of black sheriffs and mayors and governors were elected for the first time. But In the elections of 1875, the white population organized along sort of racial lines and crushed any attempt by blacks to organize and to vote in those elections. So the Democrats came back to power. And then what they were doing was, up until the Civil War, there had been no black inmates in the prison system. The prison system was just for white people that had broken the law, white males. And apparently, if you read this book, it's astonishing how violent this society was. It's just astonishing. There's just newspaper reports of even inside the political chambers, rival politicians gouging out each other's eyes and shooting each other or attacking each other with swords. And, just like three incidents like that in just one day. And so they put the most naughty of these offenders in the prison.
Naughty.
And what happened was, after the reconstruction period was cancelled by these intimidation tactics to secure power again for the Democrats, they began this system of called convict leasing. You might have heard of this.
No.
And so they... how it worked was, one guy bid for this contract, this guy called Richardson, and then he would lease out prisoners to plantation owners. So basically, you could be a freed slave. Now you've been sucked into the prison system, and now you're being leased back to work on plantations. So this is where the worse than slavery kind of aspect comes from in this book. So the convict leasing system worked very well, and later they began to develop the railroads, and convicts were leased to work on there. That would be your link with a public works project like the Trump's Wall in Mexico.
Yeah, right.
It would recall similar periods in American history. The guy that was offering the manpower, the inmates, to go and build the Mexican Wall was a sheriff in Massachusetts. It wasn't Trump himself who was suggesting that, but there was some ingratiating sheriff who was putting himself forwards to volunteer some people to go off and work on this wall. So yeah, 100 years on, not so much has changed. And the other story I had here was from the Huffington Post, and it was county jails in Mississippi moaning and crying and complaining that their local economies are going to be ruined unless the state system supplies them with more inmates, because basically without enough inmates in the jails they've built during the last surge in the prison population, they're really going to be in trouble. So it just shows that this idea of exploiting the labor of basically black people in Mississippi has just never gone away.
Am I right in thinking as well that you lived in Mississippi or ran there?
I did live in Tennessee, and I used to travel down to Alabama, and I used to spend quite a lot of time in Mississippi. Now, unlike the usual reactions, and you'll see this from a lot of Americans too, especially if they're from anywhere in the northern states, they tend to scorn the south of the country to this day. But I really loved it in the south of the US. I thought these were really very beautiful places. Mississippi was definitely one of the most beautiful places I've ever been to. In the mornings when all the mist is rising off the lakes, it was just a wonderful place. And one of the things I saw when I was down there, if we're going to talk about the kind of racial violence, is, have you seen the movie Mississippi Burning?
I think I may have. It sounds familiar.
So this is it stars Gene Hackman and Willem Dafoe.
Right, okay.
And I think it was made in the 80s. And what it did was, it focused on a notorious case of some supposed, may have been Klan organized, murder of three civil rights activists in Mississippi. Is that ringing any bells?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It does sound familiar, actually. Mr. Gene Hackman.
So it's a really wonderful movie. Willem Dafoe plays the FBI investigator, and he comes down basically not ready to take any nonsense from all the good old boys down there in Mississippi. there's one great moment where the local power elite are trying to sabotage his investigation, and the FBI has rented a kind of building in the center of town, and they've set up all their filing system there, and Defoe is doing his investigation, and they kind of come in triumphantly, one of the person that owns the building or someone passing on a message, and they say, you got to get out of here. Guy who leases the building wants you out. And Defoe just looks up and says, buy the building, you know, just pouring those federal dollars into what they're doing. So what they investigated on the basis there was, had their civil rights been infringed? Because what you had to do at that time was the local law would not necessarily charge someone with these murders, but what you had to have are these kinds of federal charges. And even though you've been murdered, basically it's a kind of civil rights violation, so the federal investigators can come in. The link here is, when I was in Mississippi back then, this would be sort of in the early part of early 2000s, one of the men who supposedly was instrumental in organizing these murders and the disposal of the bodies was this guy called Edgar Ray Killen.
Right.
Now, he had escaped justice at the time because he was a preacher. And one of the jurors famously said, you know, that they couldn't find a preacher guilty.
At all.
So he'd walked.
Only a certain
reason. Sorry, Dave. So he'd walked at the time, but he'd always kind of been fingered as being one of the people that was behind this and had organized. Basically, these civil rights activists had been detained. And then when they'd been released, they'd been trailed from the place they were released, and they were ambushed on the road, and then they were murdered, and then their bodies were disposed of in a dam, and they were later found. So at the time I went there, Edgar Ray Killen, this is why I went down there, Edgar Ray Killen was on trial again, because the pressure, the political pressure had mounted over the generations to bang him up for this crime. So I went to the courtroom when the trial was happening, and it was really an electric experience. They brought the girlfriend of one of the activists, this Mickey Schwerner, young Jewish boy from New York City. I don't know if people are aware, but at that time in the civil rights era, a lot of people would come down from the north and kind of do voter registration or help with educational programs for black people in the southern states, just saw it as their civic duty. She spoke in the courtroom and gave her account of what had happened. And just everyone around me, it was, I think, the most public emotion I've seen since I watched E.T. in the cinema when that came out, and every mum in the audience was just howling with emotional pain when E.T. died. It was really some experience. And he was found guilty. And to bring things full circle, this book of mine, Worse Than Slavery, focuses on the construction of Parchment Farm, which today is still there, and it's known as Mississippi State Penitentiary. And to complete the story, Edgar Ray Killen, this Mississippi burning guy, is now in that prison. He's serving his life sentence there. He's 89 now. So he's going to die there, I believe. That just kind of brings it full circle.
How long ago was it you was there when we were talking here?
That would be around 2004 or 2003.
Oh, okay.
So 12 years ago.
Yeah.
Then the other book I found was this Murray Bookchin. Have you heard of this guy?
No.
Oh, I'm surprised. It's called Remaking Society. That was a joke there. I think Murray Bookchin is quite a marginal figure in the sort of mainstream. But in the part of the political spectrum that he occupies, I think he's quite an influential person. So I was quite happy to find this book. And it's called Remaking Society, Pathways to a Green Future. Everything that's gone before us on the last 10 shows, I don't think anyone I'm going to think that I'm a hippie, but this book is a very interesting book which goes into his subject of social ecology. And to refer this back to the Worse Than Slavery book, I've got a very good paragraph here, a couple of sentences that reflects this kind of logic that's always been there in these southern states of the US. And what he says is this, One of the most widely accepted notions from classical times to the present is that human freedom from the domination of man by nature entails the domination of human by human as the earliest means of production and the use of human beings as instruments for harnessing the natural world. So, in order to harness the natural world, it has been argued for ages, it is necessary to harness human beings as well in the form of slaves, serfs, and workers.
Well, yeah, workers would be the current model.
But you see the link there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what that really made me think, Dave, we did speak about it this week, it made me sort of leap in my mind to where I went to live after I left the southern states of the US, because I went to live in a Mayan village in the mountains of Guatemala. It sounds like a lie, doesn't it? I was in jail for shoplifting.
Yeah, you're stuck in Coventry.
My favorite excuse for someone being in jail was I saw this boy went away, this young man, because he did a cocaine smuggling racket. And what they did was they tried to import cocaine from Panama and they hid it inside doors. So they ordered these doors from Panama, and then inside the wooden frame of the door, it was packed with cocaine. And so they were caught by the UK police, and his mum was the chairwoman of the local Conservative Party. So, of course, terribly respectable, jam-making, member of the Women's Institute, all of this thing. And you know her excuse that she made so that people wouldn't wonder where her son had disappeared to for 18 months?
Yeah, I mean.
He's doing the ski season.
The ski season?
The ski season, yeah. Where? On the Isle of Wight?
In a shower block.
Pentonville.
Yeah.
Strange ways. They've got an artificial ski slope there now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I really did go to live in Guatemala. I did live in a Mayan village. And Guatemala is one of the few places where there's still a majority population of indigenous people. So I believe it's kind of different to most of the societies that have indigenous populations because of the scale. So maybe Bolivia and Ecuador, they have large indigenous populations too. But in Guatemala, you can live in a town where everyone is an indigenous person, top to bottom. So what I realized there, sort of reflecting on what we've just talked about there, the use of serfs and slaves and workers, they didn't have that kind of domination in their local society. Basically, agriculture was the big thing, using the land to produce enough food for everyone, cutting down trees and burning wood, maybe some fishing for crabs. But they didn't have this kind of logic that the only way to make things work is to have one small class of people dominating a larger class of people and forcing them to do whatever you want and trying to pay them as little as possible. It's just a different model. That backwards approach in the US, to me, strikes me as something literally that belongs to the distant past now. Whereas the way the indigenous people live, that didn't really feel like they were, you know, it just was a more gentle way to live, far more gentle. So it was chalk and cheese going between those two environments.
Yeah, it does actually, I mean, it sounds quite a place to have lived, actually. A little Mayan village in the mountains.
There was about 10,000 people living there. It wasn't perfect by any means because the soil had become kind of exhausted over the generations there as the town had grown. So they were beginning to use more modern pesticides. And so these pesticides were kind of running down the mountain into the lake there. It didn't really matter that much to the life in the lake because this was a volcanic lake. It's more than a mile above sea level. And for whatever reason, it had very, very low oxygen content. So there's almost no life in that lake. But it did matter to the tourism because all of these phosphates or these chemicals created some kind of chemical reaction in the lake. And it began to generate what they call it was a certain kind of bacteria, like an algae formation or some kind of bacteria that the algae could feed on. So the lake began to be disfigured by this algae that was blooming in the lake. And of course, tourism was a big part of the local economy. So when that happened, it was a kind of nightmare in terms of its impact on people coming there. Don't really want to travel all the way up into the mountains of Guatemala to see a dirty, spoiled lake. So they were trying to do something about that.
And talking of far distant places, what is the situation going on with Gibraltar, would you suggest?
Well, what do you think about this? Have you ever been to Gibraltar?
I've not, no. But I just had someone this morning asking me about what we were going to be talking about. And I said one of the subjects would be Gibraltar. And again, asked if I'd been there. No. And the response I got was, there's nothing there.
A rock and some monkeys.
That's pretty much what someone said. It's just a rock. Right, so
there's a lot of businesses registered there.
Yes.
I was reading a story. It said there are only 11,000 households registered in Gibraltar, but there are more than twice that number of businesses registered there. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's one of these things like in Cayman Islands or that street. Where was it in the UK? Was it in Birmingham where there was that address with something like 15,000 businesses registered to this one house?
I don't recall that one, but
you sometimes see that it's just full of shell companies. So the economy in Gibraltar seems to function mostly by being able to benefit from access to the EU without being bound by EU rules and regulations. And the premier activity there is the provision of financial services to the EU. And I believe it was you who was mentioning this week that this, I'm not actually sure what it involves, but this sector called financial services is supposedly the largest part of the UK economy now.
Yeah, it took over from manufacturing and it's now the biggest export that the UK has, is financial services. The providing of financial services. So I would assume somewhere like Gibraltar would be, and the city of London, the city within a city or the country within a country, I imagine a lot of the financial services of a particular calibre would be also housed there.
Yes, and I think some of the online gambling sites also were based in Gibraltar because they can avoid lots of regulation if they're there. So like we said, it's, to all intents and purposes, it's kind of, it's also got tax haven kind of qualities to the place. So it's kind of useful. I'm not saying it's useful to me or to you, but for people with plenty of money, they may have become kind of accustomed to Gibraltar as a good venue for this kind of tax-free living or tax hiding assets there or hiding money there or using it as a kind of gateway to Europe for whatever kinds of loans or services you wish to provide. So that seems to be its chief purpose. Now, how did it come to be in British possession? You have to go all the way back to the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713. So I don't believe most any of us or our audience were around back then. It's a long time ago. But one of the provisions there was that the UK would take possession of Gibraltar in perpetuity. So that's the piece of paper that the British are referring to when they point to Gibraltar being theirs. The issue came up after World War II, because after World War II, the British Empire was kind of broken up. And many of the imperial possessions were returned to their, you know, their native population. So famously, India became independent. A lot of these countries became independent around 1948, right? And then the African states, it was a longer path to independence for them. So many of them went on into the 50s and 60s. That's the story. And Gibraltar and Falkland Islands, well, that's a slightly different case. But Gibraltar was not handed back to Spain.
But I was looking into the Falkland Islands the other day. I have a clip. Well, I have several clips to do with this, actually. Maybe I should play one. So this would be... Well, there's two. What one would you like to have go first, Jay? We have Lord Fallon suggesting that we're going to back Gibraltar to the hilt, basically all the way. And then we have Michael Howard. Who was it that said he had something of the night about him?
That was Anne Widdecombe. I'm glad you remember that.
Anne Widdecombe. Yes. He was also the man responsible for the pulse.
Anne Widdecombe has something of the something about her, doesn't she? She looks like the villain from some movie like Bedknobs and Broomsticks or that kind of era. Like Dick Van Dyke would be the good guy and Anne Widdecombe would be there flying around and casting spells.
Yeah, so we've got Mr. Poltax himself, Michael Howard. Basically, he's now got he's been labelled a bit of a warmonger, and this is what this is what he says.
35 years ago this week, another woman prime minister sent a task force halfway across the world to defend the freedom of another small group of British people against another Spanish-speaking country. And I'm absolutely certain that our current Prime Minister will show the same resolve in standing by the people of Gibraltar.
He actually sounds like he's also a little bit overly happy about it.
I was just thinking that. He's one of those men where he just always sounds incredibly smug, whatever he's talking about.
I am truly get the idea.
He was the era of the Conservative Party where you kind of had, you had Michael Howard, you had Anne Widdecombe, and then maybe my favourite one of of this trio was John Redwood. Remember him? And the thing about John Redwood, if Anne Widdecombe and Michael Howard looked like kind of they were grotesque, they were kind of like people from fairy tales. But John Redwood, I always used to say to my dad, he's not from Earth. He used to speak like one of the people from Star Trek would have the like a Vulcan. He really was like
he flew in on the moon spaceship.
I'd never understood how people so obviously strange, why people would ever go and put the X next to their name to elect them an MP. Anne Widdecombe was like something out of a Dickens novel, really. Her views were so backwards. And just weird and extreme. And you never could be quite sure of the next strange sentence coming from her mouth. You could present her with the best argument in the world, and she was just one of these people who would just reply with a retort. Fiddlesticks! You know, that would be a kind of answer to the thing.
It was. She had a constituency. It was in Kent, actually, I believe.
I don't know. I'm not going to blame the people of Kent for Anne Widdecombe.
Well, no, Kent's a very nice
Maybe
place.
The person she was running opposite was even worse, to be fair.
Right, so we'll have an hour.
So that was a wonderful quote. So we sent young men to slit their own throats when they were repelled by the Argentines. You had 18-year-old members of the regiments literally slitting their own throats so they would die faster. I don't think Michael Howard was there for the show, but he can sit there with his smug voice and say, we're going to propel other young men to their deaths over some little rock that we've been clinging onto desperately for 300 years, and where the biggest fear that the people that live there have is the thought of having to start working for a living. Yeah.
So we've got...
Not going to take his remarks too seriously, other than I could believe that I remember the wind-up to the Falklands campaign, and it was just a really, truly awful feeling to see this war fever blooming and blossoming throughout the UK. And we can't make any secret of the fact that it wasn't all stage managed in terms of the public reaction. The propaganda was stage managed, but it certainly struck a chord with the British people. And I think a lot of the British population really did get behind and enjoy that conflict. They really did.
It was, yeah, on the TV every night, you know, ships being blown up and various survivors being paraded around. So we've got a video now, or it's a clip, of the Defence Secretary, Sir Michael Fallon. Here we go.
We're going to look after Gibraltar. Gibraltar's going to be, well, Gibraltar's going to be protected all the way, all the way.
All the
because
way.
The sovereignty of Gibraltar cannot be changed without the agreement of the people of Gibraltar. They've made it very clear they do not want to live under Spanish rule. And it's interesting, I think, in the draft guidelines from the EU that Spain is not saying that the whole thing is subject to the transfer of sovereignty.
You see, I do get this feeling. I mean, I've spoken to a few people about this over this week. And there is generally a consensus that some of this up until coming out with these clips, unless these two guys are just joining in the propaganda. But I thought it was a bit of a fake news story, to be honest. It was a distraction.
I don't feel that it's a fake news story.
Well, it's not so much fake as in, I mean, there's obviously just playing clips, there's things going on with it. But I thought it was more of a distractional thing. Because this has been...
Well, this is where I'm going to kind of disagree with you, if that's all right. And what I would say is this. There's the interest of the average member of society. Now, to the average person in the UK, probably couldn't find Gibraltar on a map, probably never been there, and probably got no assets tucked away on Gibraltar or no business interests. It's not a big deal. But when these two speak, they are upset and they are outraged. And I don't doubt that the UK would dispatch warships and troops to Gibraltar because their interests are far deeper than our interests. And they and their friends in government and the people that control Gibraltar, they will lose money. They will lose lots of money. This is if you think of it as a racket, then Gibraltar is just this venue for a whole bunch of rackets, just like the Channel Islands are for the money laundering and the City of London. And the last thing that the English, well, specifically English, we can call them British if you want, but most of it is centered on London, is the last thing they want is to give up their rackets. They don't want to lose their rackets. And so for these guys, I believe it is a big deal. And they will, this is the Falklands all over again. They will make it the nation's interest. You know, it goes from being the interest of a few people with lots of money involved or tied up in the location. And then somehow magically it transforms into this thing called the national interest. And all that really means is they'll use every part of the state's power to defend their interests. But they'll sell it to you as they need to tie it into the average person's view of the world. And the way they usually do it is they go after either racism or nationalism or a combination of both. So we already saw with the Falkland Islands, it was brought to us as nationalism. Wasn't it? It was brought to us as nationalism. How dare those Argentines mess with the might of the British? And so we were all urged to kind of wave our flags and get behind it. But you will probably also remember from the time, Dave, that maybe even for the decade, maybe even two decades after, the disparaging use of Arges, and it became like a part of the comedy routine of a lot of these guys like Bernard Manning and these working class comedians was to tell all these basically racist jokes about Argentines. I think that kind of died a slow, very slow death too. So Michael Howard and the Fallon guy will just try and whip up the nation into feeling that it's an affront to their sense of Britishness and it's an attack on our patriotism. That's why the sovereignty thing is first and foremost. On their lips.
Well, I know there's a few people that have come out as kind of a rebuttal against Howard, saying that, you know, he's inciting, you know, all this kind of hate. It's almost hate speech, maybe you could say that, but he's not got the blessing of the Prime Minister saying that on record, I don't think.
Well, the Prime Minister is busy making friends in high places. The Prime Minister has the nerve to finger wag to the rest of the world on the horrors of Russian air power and the potential use of chemical weapons. And she's wagging her finger from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia as she goes out there to tie up some more lucrative deals for British industry with the head choppers of the Saudi regime. Yeah. Astonishing.
And it's a particular part of the British industry that she's doing trade deals on behalf of is the arms industry. Specifically,
which again is one of the most profitable sectors of the UK economy. Now, the interesting thing about the arms industry is, if you look at it, is the enormous state subsidies that go into the arms industry. And the idea here is that we must keep what they call a sovereign capability to produce these armaments, these munitions and weapon systems ourselves. That's one part of the argument. But basically what it is every taxpayer in the UK is subsidizing these companies that make huge profits. We could probably talk about the oil giants as well, who also receive massive subsidies. But the arms industry, I saw one article. It said, I will let you have a guess. How much is every worker at British Aerospace BAE Systems now? I believe it used to be called Lucas back in the day. Right. How much money do you think each worker is subsidized at BAE Systems by the public?
What, on a, what, as a total or...
No, per worker.
I wouldn't have a clue. Wouldn't absolutely have a clue. How much?
My figure was from quite a long time ago, maybe up to 10 years ago I read this article. But at that time it said each worker was subsidised by the state to the tune of
£45,000.
£45,000.
So...
of your money and my money.
Government
and
contracts.
And then you go and see that they operate, you know, and declare their profits and pay their dividends to shareholders. Where are what are these profits?
There would
be no profits if they actually had to operate like a normal company. Unfortunately, this is the kind of capitalism or business culture that we've moved towards, where basically what they call profits are just simply to do with avoiding every kind of cost that you can think of and then just declaring it the money left over profit. For example, my wife asked me about this Uber company and why there's so much trouble with them around the world. But basically, if you look at their business model, the only profitability in the Uber model is basically not paying any taxes and avoiding all of the expenses that a legitimate business would incur. That's their entire model. As soon as you can regulate them successfully and make them pay the fair amount, well, then all the profitability disappears. They're finished.
Well, that's, you see, interesting you mentioned that company. HSBC's been in the news recently. Same kind of wheel of dealing, though on a massive scale. $1.9 billion fine from the US for laundering money from drug cartels, along with loads of other stuff. I do actually have a clip where they give like a little rundown of just some of these things that people are doing.
Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation banked the British Empire while there still was a British Empire. Now headquartered in the UK and known by its initials HSBC, it's the sixth largest bank in the world, with almost 250,000 employees, over $2 trillion in assets, revenues of $60 billion, and a market capitalization of £100 billion, making it the second largest company on the London Stock Exchange. In Switzerland, HSBC's private banking division allegedly used Swiss banking secrecy laws to hide illicit money on behalf of individuals and governments who were evading taxes, evading sanctions, or engaged in corruption. In the United States, HSBC was implicated in massive money laundering by Mexican drug cartels. In 2012, HSBC got away with a sweetheart deal from Eric Holder at the Department of Justice, a $1.9 billion fine for lax controls, no criminal charges against the bank or individuals, and a deferred prosecution agreement. Holder overrode his own prosecutors, who wanted a guilty plea from the bank based on pretty unambiguous evidence that HSBC executives had actively connived to evade customer vetting requirements so they could launder at least $800 million in cartel drug money. HSBC bankers cloned thousands of accounts in the names of legitimate customers and kept them open for a few hours so they could funnel money through the bank while evading U.S. government reporting requirements.
I mean, that is just amazing. I mean, that's just a little, I mean, there's another minute's worth of that kind of stuff that this bank has been caught doing, basically. Now, what was interesting when I was looking into this, I didn't know this, but David Cameron's great-great-grandfather ran HSBC at the turn of the last century. Did you know that, Jane?
I did know it, actually.
Right. So, I mean, that would explain why, Cameron's up to his neck in this sort of scenario.
He is up to his neck in this. Sort of discuss it together. The thing we have to say there is that if anyone is falling for the distinction here between legitimate business and organized crime, then, you know, please, just because they have white faces and wear Savile Row suits and they look terribly respectable, make no mistake that HSBC is a criminal organization, and it's been repeatedly found committing all kinds of crimes all over the planet. And the people they were doing the work for there are not really, I would suggest that HSBC is not really that much better in terms of its attitude towards having any scruples about ways to make money. They're not much better than Mexican drug cartels or Iranian terror groups. Yeah.
Well,
I believe they should be disbanded as a criminal organization. Instead, they were allowed to pay a significant fine, which they'd already budgeted for. This is an enormously profitable corporation, after all. And a few people resign. No one goes to jail. And it all just carries on as before. After that scandal, they were then caught up in the LIBOR fixing scandal too. But there's a whole history of scandals. If you look them up online, I'll put them on the website. Throughout the decades, HSBC is always going around the world committing all kinds of crimes. They even sometimes commit them in the UK. Not that many of our listeners or the people walking around on the streets may have heard of it.
Well, okay, so I have a personal anecdote of HSBC, but it's interesting because my personal experience with HSBC was also something that this whistleblower, what's his name? Wilson.
Nicholas Wilson.
Nicholas Wilson, that's it. Because Nicholas Wilson worked for a legal team, a lawyer firm on behalf of HSBC, and he realised during his dealings that HSBC were illegally overcharging people, their customers, hundreds of thousands of them. And actually, he reported it to all the various bodies that would be in charge of this stuff. And they even suggested to HSBC that they would have to stop doing this until they changed the terms and conditions in their contract to reflect these charges. Until they did that, it would be illegal. Well, they carried on doing it. And this guy, Wilson, has basically ended up losing everything, but he's just won a 13-year battle with HSBC. So I was one of those customers basically using HSBC. I had an overdraft facility that then was turned into a managed loan account. On that managed loan account, over a period of several years, they would keep increasing it. Just as I was coming up to the end of the payment, they would add another £200 on it. It did lead to a fascinating conversation with a manager when I'd gone onto the company's house website. The particular company that HSBC was seemingly employing as a separate entity to deal with the heavy-handed tactics of getting back money that allegedly was owed was Metropolitan Collections Services Limited. And even when you got correspondence from this company, it would show that basically it was like a separate entity. Well, when you went onto the company's house website to find out, generally what this company made in a year, it seemed it had no employees and no expenditure. Right? So when I was speaking to a manager, I asked the manager, "Who do you work for?" And he said, "Oh, obviously, Mr. Condon, we work for the Metropolitan Collection Services, and HSBC is our only client." So I did ask him how it was possible he could work for a company that on the company's house website states very clearly that it has no employees. So it turned out that it was actually a department in HSBC that they make out to be a separate entity, as if to not to muddy the waters because of their heavy-handed tactics and their incessant overcharging and illegal overcharging. So it seems that HSBC allotted, because of this case that this Wilson brought, and one of the major issues he brought was this overcharging of actual customers illegally. It now seems that they've offered a small payment to these customers, but actually it should be millions. It runs into, they've probably done this all over the planet, not just in the UK.
The settlement is for £4 million. And Wilson says this is a derisory figure, yeah, and he believes that it could be as much as $900 million that they made from this scandal.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing, if you go on his website, is one of the tags we use for this radio show is conspiracy. And Nicholas Wilson's efforts to bring this wrongdoing by HSBC to the attention of the authorities and to gain media coverage for his legal case is really a case study in the way all the interlocking parts of the system come together to basically frustrate his efforts. Time and again, he said he would be scheduled to have a piece run in one of the national newspapers, and at the last minute, the editors would spike it without any explanation. And a little like Craig Murray, who we've also talked about, Craig Murray documents each time that he's been invited to speak on a BBC show or write an opinion piece for The Guardian. And then suddenly at the last minute, you know, the appearance is cancelled. The piece doesn't run. And he's never given an explanation why. This happened to Nicholas Wilson. Now, he also, because of this, he's proactively documented the reach of HSBC and the internet connections at the top of British society. And he calls it the corporate panopticon. I also used the panopticon as an example a few shows back. I don't know if you remember that, Dave.
What was it in relation to?
The panopticon was a prison design by Jeremy Bentham.
Oh, that's right, yes. Yes, and there was one position you could see everything, yeah.
You could, from one central position, a single individual could survey the whole prison, but that single individual could not be seen from any of the other positions.
That's it.
So what it creates is the situation where you're not sure if you're being watched. Potentially, you're being watched all of the time, wherever you are, because of this design. So he calls it the corporate panopticon because HSBC sits at the center, and he documents the very strong links between HSBC, the FCA, Financial Conduct Authority, that is supposed to independently assess complaints against HSBC, the links between HSBC and the BBC, the present, I don't know what they call the top person at the BBC these days. Is it Director General?
You know, right, okay. The Director General is...
Is Rona Fairhead.
No. Rona Fairhead is... She is the head of the Trust, BBC Trust.
Oh, sorry.
Because I thought it was...
She's a current HSBC director. She didn't even resign. And then there are links between HSBC and the MI5. And then there are links between HSBC and the Parliamentary Committee that oversees the workings of the financial sector. So they and also HSBC are the largest advertiser with Guardian Newspaper Group, with the Scott Trust. So what Nicholas Wilson kind of documents is the way that HSBC have a finger in every pie that matters, and they were able to kind of wage a counter offensive against him as he tried to bring this wrongdoing to the to public notice. Very interesting guy, and I'll put the link on his on our website for people that haven't heard of him. He was dubbed, we should say his nickname, Dave, he was dubbed Mr. Ethical when he tried to become a whistleblower at the company he was working at. That was a sarcastic nickname that was applied to him, and so he took that at face value and has kind of run with it. So he's often known as Mr. Ethical. He's a good guy.
Yeah, I mean, after listening to a few interviews of him last night, just the sheer corruption that's basically in that higher echelons of society. I mean, you know.
Oh, should we talk about one example there with David Cameron?
Yeah. Well, just
all right.
Gun.
This is a very small example of the kind of quid pro quo, the favours. David Cameron was busy trying to make Stephen Green, who was head of HSBC or had been head of HSBC, he was busy trying to give him a lordship, make him a peer. And as this was unfolding, this investigation was rolling into the consumer credit fraud that Nicholas Wilson was trying to make public. And so there was a potential expose that was going to appear in the Sunday Times on Nicholas Wilson's case. And instrumental in sabotaging this was a woman. I don't actually have her name to hand, but a woman played a significant role in thwarting this. And then later she was made a dame or a baroness, I think a dame, in the honours list by David Cameron. Because at that time, if Stephen Green and the HSB scandal had emerged, one, it would be really embarrassing if this guy lost his chance to join the great and the good at the top of society. But again, it would have been one of these issues, these scandals that brought David Cameron's judgment into question again. So for stitching up that newspaper report that the Sunday Times was going to run, Stephen Green got his gong, and the woman who helped to do that, she also got a reward like a year later. And very interesting. And Nicholas Wilson kind of details all that on his website.
I could.
Would we call that corruption, or would we call it, it's the cronyism at the top of society? That's what it really amounts to. Favours, everyone doing favours for one another.
I've got a Wilson clip where he explains just some of these kind of the shifting, rotating doors between HSBC government positions.
Also, David Cameron appointed an HSBC director to head the BBC. She still is the head of the BBC. She's the chair of the BBC Trust, which is the top position in the BBC. At the same time that she started at the BBC, very quietly, Cameron made Jonathan Evans a lord. So he brought him into the government as well. There's another lord, Lord Jandrin, who used to be the chair of HSBC Private Bank. He also sits on the Lords Committee that oversees the security services. So again, there's a connection with HSBC in the security services in the UK. They've got their finger in every government organisation in Britain.
That says it all, really, doesn't it?
Very interesting, right? Oh, but to move on there, after we've said all of that about how HSBC is this kind of evil criminal organization and they're intertwined with the British establishment, what we should say is that HSBC this week announced, as part of this transgender agenda that we focus on almost every week because something happens every week, is that HSBC are now offering their account holders 10 different pronouns that they can use to refer to themselves. And you can even invent your own pronoun if you wish, your own title. I've chosen quite a snappy one that you might be interested in, Dave.
Go on in.
FFS was my one of choice.
I'd just go by the name Banker.
I don't know if you also had that HSBC commercial they do where they tell you about the way that they're going to combat lots of financial crime, and that's why they need to collect all your personal information. That one was a hoot as well.
Right, okay, now I've got that. Right, so just...
Maybe we listen to that one and then kind of move on.
Yeah, okay.
What is financial crime? And why does it concern me? As the world becomes more connected and information moves around at a greater pace, so the opportunities for criminals to misuse the financial system also rise. Many people have heard about fraud, information security, data security, and cybercrime. But in today's complex economy, criminal activity can take many other forms, including sanctions breaches, insider trading, terrorist financing, bribery, corruption, and money laundering. These are all forms of financial...
This is all forms of the business we do.
...crime. For the most part, financial crime involves criminals obtaining money, services or property illegally or by deception and benefiting from the proceeds. In fact, it now accounts for 3.6% of global GDP, making crime one of the largest economies in the world.
Yeah.
She was reading out their own rap sheet. We turned that into satire, by the way, we set up that whole section there. So I think we can both be kind of quietly proud of ourselves. That was just pure comedy by the end.
So, yeah, talking about the bank, though, offering different pronouns, there is this whole university that I'm knocking students... marks off their essays if they don't use gender neutral language. What's your take on this then, Jack?
Well, this is the University of Hull, isn't it? Like you said, I believe that last week we kind of talked about Cardiff University and they discouraging people from referring to one another as a craftsman. I think, like I said last week, fortunately for Cardiff University, the days of the craftsman are very much numbered. I think there's about five left living in the wild in the UK. So we're not really going to have a problem with many people being referred to as craftsmen anymore. Also, sportsmanship in the age of therapeutic use exemptions and all kinds of drug taking in sport, I think sportsmanship is kind of also disappearing fast. But the whole one was interesting because it seems to my mind that it goes from this, it's the punitive part of this that is the disturbing part, really. If it was just advice, if it was just advisory, then I might be able to, even if I wouldn't necessarily support it, I could at least understand their intentions, and you could believe that their intentions are benign. But it's the deducting the marks part that I think carries it over into being kind of offensive. It's unjustifiable. And in the article that where I found out about this, much of the reaction from people opposed to it from the academic community is they're taking exception to the part about taking away the marks. It does also tie in with this kind of newspeak project of George Orwell's novel 1984, which I don't know how familiar you are with the actual novel itself, but many of the terms have kind of entered the culture. So you've probably heard of newspeak.
I have, yeah.
Now, newspeak was supposed to limit what was possible to think. So over time, certain words would kind of disappear from the language and the concept would no longer be available. So, for example, free could only mean that something did not have to be paid for. So something could be free, but it could no longer mean in any sense, like it could no longer relate to the idea of freedom. Freedom had just been kind of abolished. So the Newspeak project is kind of here alive and kicking inside the university. You need a lot of power in order to implement newspeak. So in the world of 1984, it was the whole society was subjected to this. But inside the novel, it must be said that it happened from the government were the ones implementing newspeak. When I say the whole society, actually, it was only people that were in the party workers. Those were the class. The people underneath, who are called the proles, in 1984, they're allowed to have their working class culture and they're allowed to continue using whatever language they want because they're basically just engaged in drinking, having casual sexual relationships and kind of gambling. There's that famous quote from 1984 where they just say, basically, give them a little bit of beer money and some money to put on the horses each week and you'll never have a problem with the proles. So the newspeak was being rolled out to the party workers where they needed to be more tightly controlled because they had more access to managing information, managing knowledge. So here, it's not a whole society, but it's kind of one part of an institution. It's not the whole university. It's not even a whole department. But did you read the story? It's just one course. On religious activism. I don't know why religious activism is what's brought up this finally taking the drastic step of deducting marks. But the point is, you need kind of tight control to do it, and so they're just doing this to their poor students. I'm not really too impressed. But another thing I found in reviewing Newspeak for the show was that it had a perfect word to describe what happened to the poor Muslim woman caught on Westminster Bridge doing what was required of her in that photograph. And would you like me to say the word here?
Go on in.
Face crime.
That's almost, well, yeah, I mean, the one little picture that you're referring to was when she was on a mobile phone and it was photographed like she was walking past one of the victims on Westminster Bridge, when actually witnesses turned around some time later and said she was panicking and hysterical like everyone else was at the time. So it was a photograph taken out of context, like most of these things are. But yeah, face crime. That's That's eerily familiar.
I'm guilty of face crime every time Theresa May or Boris Johnson appear on my TV screen or my smartphone. GCHQ has probably got a lot of face crime images of me snapped on my camera.
Funny little different
faces. There have been a few on this show.
But that's, it's that whole, I mean, you say about the religion, this is being brought in a kind of religious context in on the class, that there is generally this thing going on against certain festivals, sort of religious festivals, you know, Easter eggs and like that, they'll be called Easter eggs. Christmas markets, and no longer, you can't do Christmas markets, they're festive markets. You know, I've been asked on one or two occasions when doing Christmas gigs not to play religious carols. So there does seem to be this push for removing these elements of sort of religious, not religious standard, but an ethos, a religious ethos of some sense, you know. What do you
think? It's happening at the same time as well, Dave, that we had these kind of absurd David Cameron speeches about Britain being a Christian nation at its heart. So it had these kind of ridiculous offensive launched by him during his time in office, which is thankfully drawn to a close. And if you go and listen to some of David Cameron's like Christmas messages to the NATO troops or his Easter message to Britain, it's full. Thankfully, no one watched it. I think there's about 5 YouTube views. Most British people are thankfully far smarter than to waste their time listening to what David Cameron has to say about Easter. But there were these professions of faith from David Cameron as well. And famously, Tony Blair used to inflict his religiosity on us upon occasion. So the background is that on the one level, they have kind of tried to emphasize this Christian content of British society. Now, I do kind of pour scorn on it in terms of this idea that it basically mobilizes or plays a particularly prominent part in most people's lives. But one thing that you could say about it is one of the reasons why, for example, we're often told, aren't we, that Britain's not a very Christian country anymore because so few people go to church. You've heard that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, there's a counter argument to that. And I have sympathy for this counter-argument, and I first saw it by this like French historian. And he says that once a particular set of beliefs have seeped so deeply into the fabric of a particular nation, you'll find that they're there by default, and that the actual organized form of the religion might be very, you know, have a very low amount of participation. But what that actually means is that the particular message that was has been diffused to basically everyone and has just become the background hum of everyday life. So I do think that is true of the UK. If you want to call it a Christian society in that sense, then it is. You know, it's just the backbone of many people's moral judgments are drawn from this kind of Christian residue that we have. David Cameron was trying to kind of use it for a more kind of sinister ends, I think. He's just kind of, I don't know. It's supposed to act as a kind of balancing force to people feeling that their identities are under threat because of the increasing numbers of Muslims in the UK. He seemed to be having some kind of link to this kind of idea. Now, the thing you said about your Christian festival is interesting, because why should it be that if it's a Christian festival like Easter or Christmas, that it has to have its purely Christian content sort of diluted to the point where it becomes universal and anyone can attend? That seems to be the idea, right?
Yeah, completely.
So what people want is Christianity without the Christian content. Yeah. I often used to think that Christianity... I remember saying this to a Christian I met once who came to our school. I remember saying, if only you could get rid of the bit about Jesus, then Christianity would become way more popular.
Be cool, man.
I just wasn't into this idea, because I said, you keep trying to make Jesus cool, but the one thing that Jesus will never be is cool. And actually, if you really want to be cool, you need to get rid of the Jesus kind of obstacle, basically. He's holding you back. He didn't take very kindly to the idea that Jesus was holding him back. He said something like, he said, you'll be saying the Bible's holding us back next. And I said, now, it is funny that you mentioned that. I said, it's about 900 pages and no one's interested in reading 900 pages anymore. And the first bit is very exciting when the world's being created, but it very quickly becomes very boring when it's all about Egypt. And I said, no one's really interested in that now. No, I think the conversation kind of broke off at that point.
Until you get to the book of Revelations and it talks about the exciting part where the planet ends.
Yeah, it starts moving again then, doesn't it? So, like we said, they want to... the argument over the Easter one, and I was sent a very funny meme today that's been circulated, and it was a checklist of all the things that Theresa May has not got upset about. So it said, you know, Trump wanting to build a wall with Mexico, Russian hacking of the election, denying care to cancer patients. It's like a whole list of all these terrible things that have happened under her government or as world events. And then at the bottom, it's just got an X for chocolate eggs is what she's chosen to get really upset about. So she was moaning about this Easter event, this Easter egg hunt that the National Trust had organized. And what was – it's again, it's a little self-serving because, one, there kind of might be something like a pushback or a kind of war against Christianity in the sense of like county councils and educational authorities, because these are the people that try and do these events that won't offend anyone. So this is what it's all brought – this is what inspires these kinds of them telling you, please don't play any Christmas, you know, songs. Don't mention the J word. Just keep it to Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Everyone will go home happy. So there is that thing going on, but I don't believe in this kind of Bill O'Reilly Fox News kind of war on Christians and how Christians and conservatives are under attack at every single point, and you can barely walk down the street holding a Bible without people scorning you or liberals kind of trying to have you thrown in jail or silenced. It's more to do with things like councils and universities in this rush. I don't know where it quite comes from, but the idea seems to be, like we say, that in the university they call it the safe space, and in the public, in the government sphere, it's this kind of not offending anyone because we have a diverse multicultural society. So,
well, there's one particular thing that I wanted to pick up on this, where you had – I was listening to a podcast the other day, and the guy on there – he said that universities are basically turning out conformists, which is interesting because when you look at the various forms of the education system, both here and in the States, because there's similar things are going on in both countries, both continents, that you have, I suppose you could say that the left are usually the ones that are suggesting that we need to use gender-neutral language and so on. Well, when you look at certain education systems like Common Core that basically promote groupthink and anyone with any semblance of free will and a mind of their own. This is discovered through various tests that they do that are basically psychological profiling tests. And then little Johnny is diagnosed with the education system and he's failing little Johnny. Little Johnny is moved sideways out of the education system and into a massive infrastructure for mental health. And basically diagnosed with ADHD and on Ritalin by 10, right? So the only people that would end up getting through the education system would be the people who, you know, generally are promoting groupthink and going along with the flow. So the fact that you
now... Oh, sorry.
I was going to say, the fact that you now see this in universities, I mean, what kind of a vibe is a university going to be if you've got that sort of... the other slaves.
Well, I don't really see it as quite as deep as that, because for one thing, universities now have become students have become consumers because they're paying such large amounts of money. So the chance of any student being thrown off their course or being profiled and denied a place, it's the opposite. They'll take anyone to go to university now and place anyone in debt bondage, turn you into an indentured slave, as a popular word on tonight's show. But they'll just hold you in that debt bondage when you leave. So I don't believe so, because why do they need to? The debt bondage is the disciplining part of the apparatus. I think the wanting to regulate your language and kind of make you think what they think is just symptomatic of as universities withdraw kind of into themselves and don't necessarily have so many links with the outside world. Especially campus universities are where these ideas really thrive, where the academic staff solely interact with other academic staff and students. I think this is one reason also why every university, campus university, is just completely overrun with professors having affairs and sexual relations left, right and center too. It's just far too incestuous an environment. And so, no, I don't see it as linked necessarily to the Common Core. That could function much better in terms of the general education system. But once you get into higher education, I don't believe these days with, like I say, debt is the way to discipline people. That's how it works.
You said something the other day, though, Jay, that I thought was quite interesting, in the sense that when these people leave university, and if they're all in this, 100% they're all in, and, you know, and they may have the best of intentions, and of course they're going to go out back into their communities. This is what you were saying. And so, and then they'll start sort of propagating that formula, pushing it out there and making people listen and pay attention and get more people on side. And another thing you mentioned was that eventually these people will have like their own form of being able to spy each other in a social setting. And you're with us, you're one of us, you know, those over there, those are heathens. That kind of scenario.
Well, I do believe that certainly is part of the logic here, is that they'll go out and they'll be the, maybe they'll write blogs or they'll do opinion pieces.
They'll be the salesman for it.
Kind of activism afterwards, yeah. And they will just kind of propagate this language policing and carry it forward. So, yeah, I'm sure that perhaps that's one of the goals of these people that are telling them to adopt this gender-neutral language. Of course they want to disseminate it, and they don't just want to disseminate it inside their university, because, as you say, graduates will move on, and they probably hope that they'll take this kind of speech with them into whichever arena they move into. They're kind of being perfectly prepared for stints in local government by this kind of approach.
Yeah, and that, well, that's exactly what it seems like. And it's...
Go on.
I was going to suggest that it'll be easier. If this is a particular route that society is going in, it would be surely easier to include this stuff in their earliest of syllabuses as a child at school, instead of just hitting it on them when they're 18 and they're at university. If they're familiar with certain concepts, then by the time they get to that age, there's not going to be anything else to offend them. They're going to have their safe spaces. They're going to have their Play-Doh.
You are perfectly correct there. In sociology, they call these kinds of institutions, like the army is a very extreme example, but the church is an example too. And university is a kind of slightly less intense example. But these kinds of institutions, when they try to kind of recreate and rebirth the individual when they've already reached adulthood, and often, you know, you have a kind of rites of passage or initiation in the army, especially. One of the first things they do in the army is the symbolism of it. You know, you're given a number, you'll have your hair all shaved off, you'll be given clothes, you'll be fed by them. A lot of these things are the stuff of daily life in the military, of course. But when you're first going through it, it's a bit like being inducted into the prison system. You're basically, oh, and for example, the naked inspections that they'll have. You're being born again, symbolically. And what they call this process is secondary socialization. And it's never that successful because, as you rightly point out, you've already grown up and been socialized once by your parents and by your early educators and your peers. You've been socialized. So actually, they're kind of working as hard as they can to break you down and build you up again. but it's never as successful as primary socialization. The interesting thing there is, so like you say, if you wanted to take it back and make it take more successfully, you have to go after people from the youngest age and deal with them through those institutions of primary socialization. Stonewall have a five-year plan of how they're going to advance all their transgender agenda. So maybe, we've already said they want the sex education for four-year-olds.
Yep.
So maybe Stonewall are the ideas people for how the next wave of this kind of activism or this agenda is going to be imparted to the captive audiences in the nation's schools. So I can certainly imagine Stonewall wanting gender pronouns removed from children's books, for example. It would be kind of not that expensive to do. It's kind of a cosmetic change, but it would be perfectly thrilling for them to have accomplished that goal. Like you say, we have to just watch what's happening at the youngest level.
Yeah, because when it gets to the point where you've got students who are seemingly fighting for clamping down on freedom of speech, that is a kind of strange concept. Because, you know, if someone was to try and say that to me now, without having been introduced to this from a very young age, I still would have a problem with it. But if you then create this point of view that you want these kids to sort of see this particular point of view and even get them on side and then be the social police, that's kind of where it's going, I think. And it just seems to be fitting together too well to be like a haphazard accident.
We keep touching on the George Orwell references, and you use groupthink to describe Common Core. Now, groupthink also is drawn from Newspeak in 1984. And you there have just touched on, in terms of the social police and happening inside schools, you've just touched on another crucial part of 1984, and that is an organization called the Young Spies.
Oh, God.
And inside the novel, Winston Smith is the hero. He doesn't have children, but he's got a neighbor who's the most enthusiastic, he's kind of a dunderhead, but he's the most enthusiastic member. He's not a party member, but he's really enthusiastic about all of the activities that are laid on by the government, by the ruling powers of 1984. So he's always organizing for them and raising money and enthusing about everything they do. And at one point in the novel, Winston Smith has been moved to this holding cell, and he's just with this ragtag assortment of criminals. And he finds himself, he can't believe it, he's sitting next to the neighbor who he could never have believed would be able to break any of these laws on ideological purity. He's the most ardent, you know, supporter of what's going on. And he says to him, well, what are you doing here? And the man is still very proud when he says, oh, he said, my son turned me in. His son is one of the Young Spies. Every child belongs to the Young Spies.
Oh, God.
And what
they're
taught to do is to turn in their parents. And he says, my son heard me saying unpatriotic things or things against the party, against Big Brother, in my sleep. And he reported me, and now I've been brought to prison. He said, I'm so proud of my son.
That tell all that reminds me of. There was a news anchor, I think it was on CNN, and she basically says that we need to get rid of this old-fashioned concept that our children belong to us. We need to encourage the concept that our children belong to all of us. That is just, I'll have to find that for next week. But that, yeah.
Well, it is true on one level that a child basically all the forces required. Hillary Clinton wrote the book called It Takes a Village. But this book I was talking about today, the Bookchin, Murray Bookchin, he does talk about it in that book, that reproduction and the mother's relationship with her offspring are crucial in terms of human society. It's its bedrock. Oh, right. But he does point out that lots and lots of the extended group, extended family, and all different institutions are involved in the raising of a child, and that the raising of a child requires all of society, and a child kind of embodies society. So it is kind of right on one level, on a trivial level. What it doesn't mean is that institutions should be making all of the decisions about the path through life that children are going to take, which I know why you refer to it in that very negative way, because the way she presents it is not as a statement of fact, but more that there should be this kind of shift in the balance of power between institutions and the kind of faceless institutions, the bureaucracy and parents themselves, institution of the family.
Yeah, well, it's the system replaces the parents. That's kind of where that seems to be going.
But here, this last thing before we move on, I have to say this on the subject of talking in one's sleep. I read this book about the spy cops, you know, the undercover police.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I am fascinated by the dirty tricks and the campaigning and the campaigns that were undermined by the spy cops. And of course, I'm old fashioned in the sense that I would like to live in a free and open society, the one that we're always promised or assured that we do live in. But you have to really question how democratic the UK can be when you consider the undercover work of the spy cops. Now, the talking in your sleep link is because big, brave spy cops who called themselves the Harries when they went undercover, there was one thing that they were particularly terrified of, and that was having to sleep in the presence of the activists that they were busy spying on, because they faced the prospect of being lynched for what they were saying in their sleep. They were terrified of talking in their sleep. So there's one instance where one of these spy cops is at some anarchist rave or something somewhere in the forests of Germany. And one, he does know quite a lot of German, but they don't know that he speaks a lot of English. When he's doing his stuff, he kind of always does it in German. So he's terrified that he's going to start speaking English while he's asleep. And he's going to be rudely awakened by angry German anarchists wanting to know why, you know, Charlie Victor Tango was pouring out of his mouth. So that was one of the things that just did make me laugh out loud in that undercover book. It's by Rob Evans. And what's the other guy's name? I think it's called, I don't want to do him a disservice, so I won't say the other guy's name, but Rob Evans is the Guardian reporter who helped to break the, it's Evans and Lewis.
Right.
They're the two guys. I'll put that up on the website because I've slowly been making a list of books on a page of the blog.
Okay.
And that was also an excellent read. One thing I wanted to come on to as well, just to trail it for next week's show, is I have a very good article we can talk about in terms of, I mentioned the debt burden that graduates face when they leave university. I uncovered a really good article by a guy who's done a study of how academia and the scientific community and the government in the US kind of conspired to construct this idea that there was a demographic threat to the nation's scientists, the next generation, and that this was why they should introduce the visa scheme that would bring lots of science and engineering graduates from other countries to the US. What this guy has found is that there are policy documents as this debate is going on inside government and academia about how there is no need to bring in anyone from the outside. There are enough people in the US to be trained on their scientific programs. But if we just leave it to the native students, they're going to be in a strong position when they come to bargaining for pay and conditions. So what we'll do is we'll bring in lots of people from developing countries who are just grateful to be here. And they're going to make for more compliant generation of scientists, more ready to do what we tell them, more ready to do what we tell them for less than their American counterparts. So that is, as you can see, why I'm interested in that. I thought you might be interested in that too, but I thought we could talk about that next week.
Yeah, definitely. No, that does sound quite interesting. Yeah. What is it now? They're estimating £27,000, isn't it, per student? Is that generally what it is at the moment? Something like that.
£27,000 for what?
For a degree course. It's about £9,500 a year now, isn't it? Something like
that. I believe so. Yeah. They're always seeking to kind of raise this ceiling so that they can charge more. And at the same time as the academic staff are being also kind of proletarianized, there's a guy called Oppenheimer. There's a very famous article called The Proletarianization of the intellectual or the professor, something like this. Actually, I shouldn't have said it's famous, should I? It's not famous at all. But this is back in the 60s, and he's basically talking about the way, even back then, academics were being turned into nothing more than technicians, and that their paying conditions would be slowly stripped from them. That's kind of where it stands now. Instead, you just have a few superstar academics who command kind of astronomical fees and have a high public profile, and then the rest of them are basically struggling to survive. And then you've got this situation where graduate students are just used as cheap labor to teach the next generation of students. And all the while that is going on, fees are going up for the actual students themselves. The graduate opportunities are dwindling because there's so many graduates that they all have to kind of bid one another down for their graduate jobs. And then the other part would be vice chancellors of universities earning incredible amounts of money. You've probably seen this.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
They're earning things like $300,000 a year as vice chancellor of a university. And every year their increase seems to be like 5, 6, 7, 10%. It's just extraordinary.
Well, talking of people getting extremely good jobs, Andy Coulson.
Andy Coulson.
Blast from the past.
He's from the bottom, to be fair to him. He's an Essex boy.
There's nothing
made
wrong
good.
There's nothing wrong with Essex boys, man.
No, nothing at all. So he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. But he did climb his way to the top of the greasy pole,
yep,
as they call it. But he's in luck again, isn't he? Because the last time we heard about Andy Coulson, he was wearing an electronic tag.
Yeah, banged up.
After his release from prison. Now, he was sentenced to 18 months in jail. I don't know if you remember why he went to jail.
Yeah, it was the phone hacking scandal. And he'd Millie Dowler. He'd also had an affair with... What was her name? Rebecca, someone? Woman.
Rebecca Brooks. Brooks. I really wouldn't hold that against anyone.
No. It's not that. It's just that, it's that that inner circle, because Rebecca Brooks was, you know, very close friends with Cameron and his wife. And, you know, it's the same group of people. But so he's now got a new job. What's the new job title? What's he got going on?
He's become an advisor over at the Telegraph.
Telegraph. PR advisor.
That is correct. And the journalists there are really not happy about this.
That is a shocker.
But we've not reached the best part yet, have we? Because he went to jail for his conspiracy to intercept voicemail. And during that trial, it was revealed that the use of hacking of people's phones was endemic at the News of the World. Actually, it was endemic at many newspapers, but the News of the World acted as the scapegoat and absorbed all of the media attention, partly, as you said, because of the close links between the players and David Cameron. David Cameron and Rebecca Wade belonged to what they called that Chipping Norton set. And she also had that husband of hers, I think he trains racehorses.
Yeah.
So her husband was also, he was caught hiding some porn video.
Oh, that's right. There was a video, wasn't it?
And it's all they're disposing of their computers in the dead of night. And the hacking was being done, most of it, by this guy that used to be a professional footballer at a low level, like maybe played for Scunthorpe, this kind of level. And he was called Glenn Mulcair. And I think he did a bit of porridge. And then there's a few other high-ups at the News of the World who also got fingered for this. But Coulson was sentenced to 18 months and he served 5.
Yeah.
And when he came out, he had to wear electronic tag. So someone was sat in a control room somewhere, being able to monitor the movements of Andy Coulson's legs in real time, make sure he wasn't menacing anyone or hacking anyone's phone.
Or disposing of porn.
Disposing of pornography. But then later, he also ran into all the legal cost problems. He tried to have News International cover all of his costs, but that didn't quite work out after an appeal. And finally, he was ordered to pay $150,000 of his own money, a terrifying prospect, having to spend your own money. But It's not clear yet if he's actually done that, but they said if he doesn't do it, and the order was made last year, he's got 3 years to pay back his 150 grand. I think with his new job at the Telegraph, it might be his first paycheck is to clear this, these court costs, so he can kind of move on with his life. But yeah, he's fallen on his feet. But one of the things, this is what makes it so funny, or tragic, depending on your view, is that he's going to help promote the Telegraph Group's newspapers, and he's going to promote these newspapers as truthful and authoritative. And the journalists working there, one of them said, this can't do anything but harm to our brand. Yeah. It will deal a severe blow to the credibility of our journalism. So you might ask how he got this job.
Yeah.
But the reason is, the guy who hired him is this guy called McLennan, who actually gave a character reference on Coulson's behalf at his the trial where Coulson was found guilty. And he said at that trial, I've always admired Andy, and I've always found him extremely honest and reliable. And he's often said that Coulson should never have been arrested. So again, like we said, it's this kind of cronyism. Once you're in, and having been to jail is no barrier to kind of returning to the fold. He's the prodigal son. So he's just been hired on, and he's got involved with this new project, Andy Coulson. It's a company he's running that's taken this on. They're called Coulson Chapel. He's got involved with this guy called Henry Chapel, who specializes in like sports journalism. But they've got a website, and their website is just one page with no information. And it just says, we offer discreet advice with from a unique perspective on corporate strategy. So you can decide what that means. But it certainly doesn't come cheap.
No, it's just, surely wasn't there someone in the office who said that, Andy Coulson, isn't this the same guy that got caught hacking people's phones? What is he doing working for another newspaper?
There's far more about the hacking trial that we could go into here. It was a much deeper...
Oh, yeah, it was huge. It
was a much deeper set of issues that never really made it into the public domain. One guy whose name never really appeared as much in the newspapers as it should is Jonathan Rees. Do you know him?
No. Who was he?
Well, Jonathan Rees was the head of this company called Southern Investigations.
Right.
If you're really going down the rabbit hole or taking, what is it, the blue pill from the Matrix,
right,
then Jonathan Rees is a great place to start. Because Jonathan Rees and his activities, his criminal activities, he used to be a police officer, and his activities centered around Deptford. Is Deptford part of London, Dave? I think you know this Deptford. Part of the world better.
Yeah, Deptford. Yeah, East London. Yeah.
He moved into the information business, and so he was running an information service and a hacking service for the tabloids. And they had a lot of corrupt police officers on the payroll. And when I mention this next case, I think maybe the penny will drop or the bells will ring, and that is the murder of Daniel Morgan.
Okay.
Daniel Morgan is the... He was a private investigator, sorry. And he's the private investigator that was famously found with an axe buried in his head in a pub car park.
Oh, right. Was it self-inflicted?
It would be suicide, wouldn't it, if Freddie Patel was doing the autopsy? Yes, no, sorry, Daniel Morgan's murder is linked very closely to associates of Jonathan Rees. And this has become an ongoing campaign by Alistair Morgan, Daniel Morgan's brother. And he's produced like a very successful podcast in the last few years. They've been trying to get it investigated again and again. There are also links that can be traced to the Stephen Lawrence crime family, the Norrises, linked with these police officers too. I'll put this book up on the website. We won't talk about it tonight, okay, because I'm not being fair to you, Dave. You'd need to do your homework on it too.
Okay.
But there's an amazing book. Some of the people listening might have read it, and it's called The Untouchables. And it's all the inside story of the Metropolitan Police and all of the dirty dealing that was going on inside. And, for example, one central episode in this book is the Brinksmat robbery.
Yeah, we all remember
now,
that.
Much of the Brinksmat gold, once it was melted down and it was recycled and money laundered, it's quite amusing to me that there was a story about how much money from the proceeds had been recovered by the police, and they were citing some figure like 200,000. Yeah, if they really, if you really want to know where the Brinksmap money went, a lot of it, it went through the pockets of corrupt police officers being paid for information on the investigations into the criminals that carried out the robbery itself. So Kenneth Noy, are you familiar with Kenneth Noy?
Yeah, there wasn't there a film made about these, the alleged participants in the Brinks Mat? It was like an Essex crew.
Mm. Kenneth Noy is a Freemason, among other things.
Yeah.
But he came, he was notorious as a professional criminal from the Brinksmack case. And to give an idea of the kind of character of the man, he escaped a murder rap when he killed an undercover policeman in his garden. Noy came out of the house and discovered the undercover policeman there and finished him off with a knife. But then Noy became notorious on the on a national level again when he killed a driver in a road rage incident.
Yeah, I remember.
I think it was on the M25.
Yeah.
And then he fled and he was in Spain. And The Untouchables details the way Noy had a lot of corrupt police officers on 10 grand retainers a month. Funneling him information on the investigation into him. So this book, The Untouchables, it would be a great one if you had looked at it yourself too, and we could kind of pick up on some of those issues in a future show.
Okay, I'll look into that. I still actually own, I possess 1984, the book. Someone bought it for me a few years back, and I still haven't got around to reading it. Maybe I should do.
Well, like we said about the Bible having seeped into English culture or British culture, 1984 has kind of seeped into the culture itself. So if I say the things to you and you know the concepts, you probably don't really need to read the book. You know what a telescreen is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Check. You know who Big Brother is.
Like,
you know who Big Brother is. You have to love Big Brother.
Yeah, next we have the telescreen.
They have the Ministry of Truth, Mini-True, which does nothing but broadcast lies. Yeah. They have the Ministry of Peace, which wages endless war. In the story, you might know this one as well, that they say in the at one point in the story, there's this war been going on, that they're perpetually at war with Eurasia. Now, Eurasia would be kind of the Eurasian landmass. And then there's another area called East Asia. And at one point, they've been at war supposedly permanently with Eurasia for as long as anyone can remember. And they've all got programmed memories anyway. But there's a guy on stage and he's just announcing this war again with Eurasia. And he's handed a piece of paper and it basically changes it mid-sentence from who they're at war with and who they've always been at war with. And he just reads it out. Now, you know, we're at war with East Asia. And Winston Smith, the hero, is kind of looking at the audience thinking, well, they can't possibly swallow that. You know, even yesterday, all the TV was just full of, we're at war with Eurasia and we always have been and always will be. How can they swallow this? It's just so obvious, you know. But he sees everyone in the audience like reprogramming, recalibrating themselves and policing one another. And then they all just jump up and start shouting, you know, death to East Asia. Death to East Asia. It's that kind of ability that people will reprogram themselves because of what you've drummed into them, what you've conditioned them to do.
Yeah, I'm familiar with a lot of the concepts. That
so if we have to go to war with Gibraltar, over Gibraltar, then in short order, we're going to learn all kinds of things about our long-standing grievances with the Spanish, no doubt, and why we need to teach those... What are the kind of racial stereotypes of Spanish people? They're kind of seen as oily or greasy traditionally. So we'll be hearing some of that, I suppose, if we start progressing beyond the saber-rattling stage, as they like to call it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure Katie Hopkins will have an article to point us in the right direction on just how we're supposed to froth at the mouth over this.
Well, okay, we're talking to Katie Hopkins. Obviously, we've got some clips left over from the little slot that we did. And we can't, as you said the other day, Jay, we can't play it all in one hit because we'll end up with no listeners. Right?
That is true. And also it could bring people out in hives, all kinds of skin complaints if we play too many in a row.
Just nasty stuff.
Anyone listening might want to put on a mask or open a window right now.
Yeah, you're going to break out the bottles of Dettol, right? So we've got, we had five clips. We played the last one. That was the Down There kid, you know.
God, you know, God rest his soul or whatever, you know. His heart was in the right place, even if his mind isn't quite fully formed yet.
So we've got an NHS question. Should we allow the free market to come in? She was asked the question that ever considered running for BNP. So we've got the answer to that one. Or we've got the Down There kid again asking something pertaining to IQ. Her IQ.
Look, don't make us relive it all over again, Dave. Just play the clip.
Just okay. We'll go for the. Right, hang on in. The NHS one, I think we'll go for. If I can find it, there we go. And sweet.
What should we do about the NHS? Should we allow free market to come in?
Yes, absolutely. So for me, I would change the NHS dramatically. I would move to a private health insurance market. I think if you're obese, if you're fat, if you're overweight, you should pay more. Oh, gasps. Are you all right? Do you need oxygen, darling? You should pay more if you're fat. If you've made bad health choices, you should pay more for that. If you smoke, you should pay more for that. No, of course, that would be exempt. Same with people like me who have epilepsy. I can't see myself having to pay more for that, but maybe I will. I accept the market is a tough master, but I buy into it absolutely.
Do you think people lack personal responsibility for their own actions?
I think that's where probably government and the state comes in. So state pretends to or is required to be a sort of policing force, and obviously it provides the necessary services that we need. But I do think the hand of the state needs to be taken back, drawn back. I mean, for a very light touch. I don't believe in the state smothering every choice we make.
Should we get rid of the benefit system?
For me, I think enterprise comes with a very, very limited benefit system. So I don't believe in a big benefit system. I think what the Conservative Party are doing has been fantastic. I think pulling it back to a maximum of still £500, still feels like a massive amount for people that are going out and working to get that money.
Do you think we live in a society that's too focused upon morals rather than upon more pragmatic?
Yes, I don't. You know, this wave of, well, if, for example, the Conservative Party, when they started leaping around on huskies, going to be the greenest party of our time, and now they've decided to dump the green shit, their words. I think that's probably exactly where we're at, because we wanted to pretend to be more green, more if that's indicative of more moral. And now we've recognised that actually the market is what counts.
So, yeah, it's the market. It's all about the market.
Well, what can we say about that, Dave? The first part about, for example, the health choices that people make.
Yeah.
Did you see an article this week The Guardian had? I don't know how much you read The Guardian. I know people listening probably sick of hearing me say about reading The Guardian by now. I read all of the newspapers, but unfortunately, for certain types of issues, The Guardian is the only one that will run these stories, and they're not going to be on the front of the Daily Express. You know, nothing's going to dislodge stories about Diana.
No, of course not.
No, unless it's Paul Burrell's wedding, which you may have seen this week.
But Burrell?
Oh, I call him Burrell. I sound too posh saying Burrell, right? Burrell.
Burrell.
Burrell. Paul Burrell.
It's Burrell, sir.
Burrell. The son of Burrell.
So,
he's married his partner in a specially designed tartan, Clan Burrell or Clan Burrell, McBurrell. Yeah. And he was wearing a ring of Diana's, apparently. Of course he was when he was getting. I'm surprised he'd get married on the anniversary of her death in the underpass in Paris.
Yeah. Yeah, being
That'd be
escorted.
A kind of classy Burrell stroke.
Being escorted to and from the ceremony in a white Fiat.
Yeah, so just to return to this issue of personal responsibility for one's health. For one, we don't choose who our parents are, and our parents basically raise us. They do play a large part in our in raising us. So we don't choose who our parents are, and we don't choose the kind of accommodation and diet that we're provided with. So a lot of things from an early age set you on a particular path in terms of your what your prospects are for your adult health. Now, the other thing that she, and basically what these things are, there's a word for them or a phrase, they're called the social determinants of health. Now, I know Katie Burrell likes to talk about personal responsibility, but it's been demonstrably the case that there are all kinds of social factors that impinge upon your health over the course of your lifetime. And now the story I'm going to refer to is a report has come out about the devastating levels of air pollution in the UK in certain hotspots. Now, you don't necessarily know if you live in one of these hotspots. People don't walk around traditionally carrying Geiger counters or filters to measure the air quality. Actually, it is councils and universities and state agencies that care about this. No business would be sending anyone around to measure the air quality. And if they did, they would only be telling you that it's fine, carry on breathing. So this report has come out and it pinpointed that a lot of the worst pollution hotspots are in the West Midlands, where I grew up. Now, anyone that's been to Tamworth or driven around Birmingham or Coventry will know that it's no exaggeration to say that the car is absolutely king in that part of the country. And what they found was that there are lots of primary schools and schools sited quite close to some of these hotspots. And staff at the schools, now some of the staff have been quoted as saying on a kind of, they just had like folk knowledge or an intuition that they shouldn't let the children play outside too much because they can also, you know, directly feel that the air is not really good to breathe. So there's that part, but they didn't have the data, the empirical data to back this up. So Katie Hopkins, when she talks about everyone taking personal responsibility for their health, yes, there is a kind of reckless part to some people's lifestyles, but it's not across the board that you can exercise, 100% control over the direction that your health is going to take. And the market will not differentiate actually between the self-inflicted and the stuff that is just unfortunately, you know, either just pure bad luck or the social determinants, the social factors that have contributed. So in practice, what you'll find is a private system, a private market is going to make everyone pay more. They're not going to care, you know, that you're obese for whatever reason. There's just going to be the premium applied. When I lived in the US, for example, you would buy a health plan and then basically, because I was already over 30 years of age, any single condition that you go to the doctors and have diagnosed will be diagnosed as pre-existing condition. So if you go there and you've got some terrible allergy that's developed, they'll go back and see if you've had an allergy test or a pollen test back when you were a child. And they will use that to say pre-existing condition. You have to pay yourself. So it becomes this way to basically pass all of the costs onto you, all of them. So it's not a very successful system. I don't really think Katie Hopkins knows what she's talking about. The other thing with the private healthcare system too is there are certain diseases where there's no money in it for private health providers. So they will always be passing those on to the public sector. One thing that you'll notice is there's very little in the way of private sector interest in cancer treatments, long-term cancer care. There's no interest at all because there's no money in it for them. So the market will only want to treat all of the easily treatable conditions. And they aren't actually that interested in emergency medicine either. So you end up with the kind of the worst of both. You'll have the private sector want all the easily done procedures, all the elective procedures. They want to do those and charge you massive amounts for doing them. And then they want the NHS to be shouldered with the burden of all the expensive treatments that you can't make much money out of. Right. So it's not a good system. And Katie Hopkins' idea that, you know, if you make the right choices, then you'll be judged fairly by the market. It's just so naive. It's just incredible. And it is almost endearing that she believes that the market is going to say, well, it's not your fault you've got epilepsy, Katie. We'll give you the special, special discount when it's not your fault, right? Yeah, and then she actually even says it herself. Oh, hold on. Maybe they will make me pay more.
Yeah.
Of course they'll make you pay more. They'll make you pay. You know, the private healthcare, why they're so interested is when it's your health or the health of your a member of your family, a loved one, you are over a barrel. You are over a barrel. And if you actually say to these people, well, how much is it going to cost? It is going to be, the answer is going to be, how much have you got? Because the answer is all of it. That's how much it will cost. Everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they do like to try and get hold of old people, especially because old people have got sitting on their asset. You see this in the US. The one asset that a lot of elderly people have is their home.
Yeah.
And they would like to pass this on to their family. But they make absolutely sure that your final medical bill will necessitate selling basically all of grandma or granddad's assets and handing them over to a medical corporation, and the children are left with nothing. I do believe this is one reason why euthanasia is kind of being resisted, because if people could be euthanized at like Dignitas Clinic and could plan their death, it would really cut these guys out of all the money that they're making from offering all this kind of terminal care. The bills that people run up in just like a month of kind of palliative care as they die of cancer, these enormous bills that suck every penny out of someone, would all be kind of done away with. I would actually, I don't know what your view is, but on that basis, I would kind of favor euthanasia, because it would take people's power back and it would allow people to step back from this kind of exploitation of dying old people.
Well, being a fan of sci-fi, I'd probably take a leaf out of Logan's Run book. Do you remember that? Little crystals in the middle of your hand?
Of course I remember that. But the other one is Soylent Green as well, has euthanasia, when you basically, you realise that your life is just so hopeless. And you finally get the message that it's not worth living anymore. You go along to the clinic there and they give you this beautiful last kind of day on earth, day of life, where they cook your favourite dinner and they play some music that you've chosen and show you a beautiful film of the Swiss Alps and all the flowers in bloom. And then when you die, as the Charlton Heston character finds out, he hangs onto the back of the truck and follows the body of his best friend to its final resting place, and is most alarmed to discover that it's a meat processing plant. And what happens at the end is he discovers that the new food that all the homeless people, because everyone's homeless basically in the story now, everyone's starving, the new food that the government throws out on the street to just basically keep them alive another day is this Soylent Green. And so it ends. I don't think I'm really spoiling anything here.
Oh, no,
do you want to say the last line?
Yeah, might as well. Christ.
No, you say it, Dave.
Soylent Green is people.
That's a great place to end the show this week.
And then he gets carted off being crazy. But all right, excellent. Well, thank you very much this week, Jay. It's been a good show this week.
I think this was a wonderful show. That's just my opinion, of course. If you want to write a comment telling me that I'm flat out wrong and it was garbage, then you can go along to our page on Mixcloud or make use of the Book Armor comment facility on it on the last show or this show. And you can just tell us what you think. It would be great to hear from people. We do say this every week.
Yeah, but definitely.
So far, the response has been, I would characterize the response to our show as far from overwhelming.
Distinctively muted.
Muted, indeed. Silent.
Right. Well, thank you, Jay. Thank you, everyone.
However,
for listening.
We shall return next week regardless. We're not giving up. This is not our sign-off show. We've enjoyed tonight's show and we'll definitely be back for more next time.
Right. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.
And take care.
Defuse the ticking time bomb of tension which could explode into a conflict.
We were walking right on the edge. We were walking right on the edge.
This world would be pretty easy and fast-paced to live if everybody did.